Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does the study of history in middle and high school actually leave American kids less informed about the events that shape our world? Having observed the process for decades as a professor and as a writer of textbooks himself, and worked with teachers currently laboring in the K-12 trenches, James Lowen worries that history is the only subject in which kids with a lot of background are less prepared for college-level work than their peers. The problem? Many of the history textbooks written for public school students are full of inaccuracies and ethnocentric bias, and even those that get the facts right tend to go a mile wide and an inch deep, meaning few kids fully engage in a subject that is imperative for informed participation in the democratic process. He writes about the problem and suggests practical solutions in his new book, Teaching What Really Happened: How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. Jim, welcome back to Think.
Glad to be with you.
Talk about why studying history tends to make our kids stupid.
Yeah, isn't that a heck of a claim? Well, first let me establish the claim. For instance, a friend of mine teaches the survey course, American History 1 and 2, at the University of Vermont, and has for years. And I need to mention that the University of Vermont is a national school and gets more than 60% of its students from outside of Vermont. So this is not a Vermont problem. This is a U.S. problem. He calls his course, nicknames it, Iconoclasm 1 and 2, because he has to break the icons, that is, destroy the wrong images of the past that students have imbibed in high school and prior to high school. He would rather have foreign students who either don't know anything about American history, which means they start out at zero instead of like minus 10, or sometimes they actually have learned some pretty good history. So that's not unusual. That's the typical regard that historians in college hold high school history. Now, that's not true in any other field. Math professors are delighted if you in high school had a whole bunch of math. They'll put you in, well, they'll give you a test to make sure you learned it, but then they'll put you in advanced calculus instead of regular calculus. Your Shakespeare teacher in college would be delighted if you had not only the usual Romeo and Juliet, but also you had have read and thought about Lear and Macbeth, let's say. He or she might not teach Lear exactly the same as your high school teacher did, but you've read the original book, you've thought about it. That's nothing but good stuff. But that's not how it is in history.
And most distressingly, you found this on a number of occasions, sometimes the people who write the books know better than what they're putting in there, but they put into those textbooks the stories that the textbook boards want to see.
Well, that's true. But even worse than that is, more often, the people who write the books don't write the books. Or to put it another way, they rent their names out, and the books are in fact written by flacks, by hacks, by clerks, or by people that part-timers that the publishers just happen to employ. And sometimes they have a PhD in history, and sometimes, as in the case of a woman who came up after I gave a talk about all this, and she said, "You're absolutely right." She says, "I rewrote the Civil War chapter for one of the major publishers," and she named the publisher. And she said, furthermore, they didn't even include some of my corrections, even though I had done research and I knew they were right. And I said, "That's great," or "terrible." I said, "What's your qualification?" And she said, "Well, I have a BA in English."
Huh. Yeah, you point out here that there are more teachers teaching out of field in the subject of history than any other academic subject.
Yep.
Does that speak to the fact, Jim, that we don't value its importance, or that we just assume we can trust what's written in the books?
Maybe both. I think it's mostly that we don't value its importance. My bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, of course, we're talking today about teaching what really happened, but I hold up my bestseller sometimes, and I say, this book could have been subtitled, Revenge Against Coach DeMolin, because he was my history teacher. Well, now, I was in Texas when I asked this question. In fact, I was at Texas A&M Commerce. And it was a very important talk. It was called Convocation, which they have once every semester. The whole faculty turned out in their academic regalia. It was a beautiful audience. There are hundreds of people there. And I said, how many of you had a high school history teacher whose first name was Coach? And applause ricocheted through the auditorium, and 60% of my audience raised their hands. So Texas wins the prize. I've asked the question most recently in Nebraska, and only 45% there. Well, what is that saying? It's not that I'm against coaches, but I'm not talking about a history teacher who also coaches soccer. Coach DeMolin knew perfectly well that he was not hired and fired on the basis of how he taught history. He was hired and fired on the basis of the one-loss record of, in his case, the basketball team. And so he didn't give a damn about how he taught history, and it showed. All we did was read the book and then answer those endless 55 questions at the end of each chapter. You know, my favorite is, when did the War of 1812 start? But, you know, whatever. So that's an outrage. And at least 15% and more in Texas of the people teaching American history in high school are first and foremost coaches. You can't imagine Coach DeMolin teaching English. The students are going to come out illiterate. You know, we can't have that. And even Coach DeMolin can't imagine himself teaching math. And so the idea is, let's have him teach something that doesn't matter. Let's have him teach history or social studies. And so at the same time, this not only messes up my class, it also demoralizes the rest of the department because they realize that their subject is not valued by the central administration.
So you argue here that it's critical for teachers to free themselves from the straitjacket of the textbooks that they're given to teach from. Can that work for the Coach DeMolins of the world who don't have personal expertise in history? Can they build that to the extent that they feel confident teaching other than what appears in that textbook?
Well, that's the problem. People like Coach DeMolin use the textbook as a crutch. And in fact, the publishers make it even easier. They try to sell it to you as a crutch. They advertise what they call their ancillaries. These are, well, for example, a typical ancillary is a CD-ROM with 10,000 multiple-choice questions, maybe 100 for each chapter. Oh, no, that'd be about 200 for each chapter, probably. You don't have to think. Not only that, you don't even have to choose them. The darn CD-ROM sometimes comes with a random digit chooser so that you can choose a random sample from chapter 23, and that way your students cannot possibly pass on the answer to next year's students because they're going to get a different random sample. And you don't need to think at all, you know. It'll generate the questions, and then all you have to do is photocopy them. Well, yeah, for the Coach DeMolins of the world, that's great. The rest of us, and I think most history teachers, are trying to do a good job. They want to go beyond the textbook. And I think there's two things that deter them. First, many of them don't really know how. Sometimes they actually got some stuff on how to do this in grad school, but somehow that dissipates, and what they really remember is how they were taught, and so they tend to teach the way they were taught. And so that's why what I recommend your listeners do is get a copy of Teaching What Really Happened. This is actually the first book of mine I've ever flogged. The rest of them, you know, they seem to sell by themselves. Well, this one's doing all right, but the reason I'm flogging it, the reason I want people to actually buy it, is I want them to read it, and then I want them to keep it nice. That is, take notes on a separate piece of paper. Don't mess it up. And then give it to the teacher you had in high school who didn't teach you any of this stuff, or give it to your kid's teacher who's unlikely to teach them any of this stuff. And they'll read it, coming from a parent or coming from an alum, and it'll improve the world. They'll actually be able to go beyond the textbook because this book shows them how.
Your idea for teachers who do, in fact, want to go beyond the textbook is that they use this as a starting point, but pick 30 to 50 topics out of what sometimes is hundreds to really focus on throughout the year. What does that change in terms of the classroom experience and the way that students engage with the material?
Well, if you try to cover all the stuff that's in the history text, you will cover a lot of stuff, but you will not discover anything, you will not uncover anything, and you will bore everyone. These textbooks have actually gotten longer. You can remember how long they were. They were the heaviest thing you ever took home, were they not?
Absolutely.
Yep. And they've now gone from an average of 888 pages, they now average 1,152 pages.
And this is for junior high and high school kids.
Yeah. It's a terrible idea. Well, five of those six were high school textbooks, and one is a middle school text. Mm-hmm. The middle school textbook actually is the heaviest of them all because although it doesn't have 1,100 pages, its pages are even bigger. It's a huge, heavy book. This has actually become a problem, I kid you not, for the American Chiropractic Association.
Their backpacks are too full.
Yeah, and that's why some folks are switching to the roller, you know, the what we used to call stewardess bags.
Right, right.
It's very bad.
So, you know, the problem, I guess, is that everybody has a dog in the fight about what needs to be covered. Can you talk about how you recommend teachers pick those 30 to 50 subjects, knowing that they will therefore have to leave something out that somebody considers important?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, what you said went past awfully quick. Let me highlight it. Teachers need not, should not, and even cannot teach all of the subjects. Now, in a textbook. Now, a textbook has maybe 42 chapters, but it doesn't treat 42 things. Each of those chapters treats just a whole bunch of things, a melange of things. So the number of things it's actually treating, number in the hundreds. In fact, I made a count of the essential ideas, as one textbook calls, you know, bolds a whole bunch of things, and they have something like 442 essential ideas. Then they have central themes or something like that, and have another 300 of those, and so on. It's just impossible to try to remember all these, what I call, twigs. Nobody can do it, nobody wants to, and nobody achieves it. So I think every single history teacher of American history needs to choose 30 to 50 topics. And it's interesting, in world history, teachers already know this. I mean, teachers know that they cannot possibly cover world history. I mean, imagine if you were trying to cover world history, and here it is, let's say it's February 11th, and you say, okay, we have 11 minutes now on the history of Malaysia, followed by 17 minutes on the history of Indonesia, and then we'll have a whole 22 minutes on the history of the Philippines. I mean, nobody would even try it. You have to pick and choose. But somehow in American history, a lot of people think, well, we're going to try to cover it. We're going to try to cover it all, and it just doesn't work. So the 30 to 50, how do you choose them? Well, I think every single one of them needs to be, first of all, something that you, the teacher, are excited about, that you want to teach. Now, I'll get back to that in a minute. Second of all, every single one of them needs to have some kind of relevance to the present. Now, I submit to you, almost everything does have relevance to the present, but you, the teacher, have to understand that relevance, have to want to bring it out. And the third thing is that you, the teacher, for each of these 30 to 50 things, needs to develop some kind of interesting way to teach it. Now, in some cases, that might even be using the textbook. You know, maybe the textbook is really great on, let's say, the Civil War. Maybe it's got terrific maps, and the military history is particularly well covered, and you can supplement some of the other stuff. I don't know. Maybe for another one, you want to teach it by means of a term paper, of all things, which actually turns out to take a whole lot of class time. It sounds like it won't, but it does, et cetera. Now, this list can't be totally arbitrary. If you leave out the making and use of the Constitution, let's say, well, you have an incompetent list. If you leave out the impact of the Civil War and its impact, we'll say, then you've got a bad list. But there's lots of things. Like, let me ask you this. I mean, let me just ask the listeners this. Do you have to include the national bank crisis that happened under the Andrew Jackson administration? Well, it turns out if you do right now, it's particularly timely because it relates to issues of, you know, Wall Street and what the role of the federal government is and all this and stuff, and it'd be quite interesting. But I've never quite wrapped my mind around it. I don't quite know how to teach it. I'm not enthusiastic about teaching it. Well, that signals to me, Loewen, you shouldn't teach that. When you're talking about the Andrew Jackson administration, why don't you focus about the removal of the Indians, the so-called five civilized tribes?
Let me stop you right there. We have to take a quick break. James W. Loewen is my guest. The new book is called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James W. Lowen. He is a sociologist, writer, and lecturer. His newest book is called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Jim, you were talking about the fact that you don't necessarily have to teach the banking crisis that took place in the Jackson administration. You can find something else that links to today's crisis as long as students get the concept.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Talk for a minute about Native Americans, because this is another place where you, ordinarily people would say you have to teach what happened on the Trail of Tears, but you met a teacher who said, that's important, but I can link the displacement of Native peoples to a story that happened closer to home, and I think she was in North Dakota or somewhere.
Yeah, she was in Minnesota, actually.
Minnesota. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in Minnesota, there was, in 1862-63, what's sometimes called the Lakota Uprising or the Sioux War. And she said, this not only happened in Minnesota, it happened in my part of Minnesota. I want to teach that. I don't want to teach the removal of the Indians from the Southeast. And I said to her, fine, you go, you do that, you know. Now, I think that if you have a list of 30 to 50 topics, and not a single one of them ever treats the removal of the Native Americans from much of the land and our taking the land, then again, you have an incompetent list. And let me make a suggestion, another way to do it, besides teaching about the, it's usually called the Cherokee Trail of Tears, which is a good one to pick. There's lots of sources available on it, and there's good ways to do it. But another possibility is, and it works even in Texas, I say even because Texas is quite a ways away from where it happened or where it didn't happen, you get your students discussing, have they ever heard, you ask them, what's the most important purchase in the history of the country for the exact sum of $24? And in fact, it was $24 worth of beads. And of course, many, many students, including in Texas, in California, all over the place, will reply, the purchase of Manhattan. It never happened. Nothing like that ever happened. I have a whole chapter on it in Teaching What Really Happened. But the fact that students already know it is kind of a leg up, because then you can say to them, well, no, that's what you got told. When did you learn that? You can kind of explore it with them. Usually it's like in second grade or third grade. I think my second grade teacher did it to me. And then you start saying, well, now, first of all, does it even make sense? And I show a picture of a typical Eastern Indian village. You know, it's got houses, for heaven's sakes. It's got gardens. It's got fields. And there's hunting rights throughout the island and so on. Would anybody give up their share of that for their share of this piddly little $24 worth of beads? Surely not. And then do what? Move to New Jersey? You know, there's already people living there. You'd have to fight them for it. You'd have to argue with them about it. So it's just totally implausible when you think about it. But then you can ask students, and I'm asking your listeners right now, what is the most famous street in America, especially these last 2 years? And, of course, it's Wall Street, and it's named for the wall that the Dutch built across the upper edge of their settlement down in Manhattan, at the lower end of it, to keep out attacks from the Wachiskiks, who owned Manhattan. And the Wachiskiks weren't happy with the Dutch presence, and they warred with the Dutch sporadically for years, and then finally, in 1644, the Dutch exterminated them. Well, that's what really happened. And, you know, we can face that. We don't have to lie and tell this silly little fable about $24 worth of beads.
Well, I think the great thing about that is what you do is trigger this sort of righteous indignation on the part of the students, and then they want to know what did really happen.
Yeah, and they also want to know, what else did we get lied to in elementary school?
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. I want to talk just a minute about this problem we seem to have in teaching history with American exceptionalism and ethnocentrism. You know, we've long looked at history as this tool for acculturating new immigrants to this country and educating them about what, quote, every American should know, end quote. If we really wanted to accomplish that, how would we have to change the curriculum?
If we wanted to accomplish what?
If we really wanted to sort of teach new immigrants, there's this idea you send them to school and they're going to know what they need to know as Americans.
Well, I actually think that we can get immigrants to buy into American history just as well as, or as poorly, unfortunately, as we get the rest of us to buy into it. But we do have to make that effort. One way that I suggest that we get all students interested in learning history is by getting them to do history. That is, actually write some history. Do local history, learn about the history of their hometown, learn about the women's movement and how it affected the church they're a member of, or whatever. And when you're doing that, a recent immigrant, let's say a Mexican immigrant or a Cambodian immigrant or whatever, has a leg up because they've had an interesting family history and a family history that resonates with important national issues. And so you can get your students in middle school or high school to interview the oldest member of your family. If they're speaking in a different language, then translate it and transcribe it. Get it all written down accurately. The drama of their coming to America, the drama of their finding their first job, finding a house, how do you make it, what do you do, and so on. And if everybody in the whole class does that, you wind up with a batch of work by this fifth grade class or this 11th grade class that's really quite exceptional. And when you get done and the teacher expects a whole lot and says, you've got to do a good job, this is the story of your family, this is important, then you bind it. You don't just Xerox it. You go to Kinko's or copy shop or wherever, and you bind a copy, and you put it in the community library, not just the high school library, with a call number. And now your students have combined, and they've written a book. And it's a great book. I mean, that is to say, 50 years from now, some hapless PhD candidate at UT Austin or someplace is going to be interested in immigrants in the first half of the 21st century, and they're going to come upon this, and they're going to think Santa Claus has bestowed a great gift on them, and indeed, Santa has.
James Lowen is my guest. The new book is called Teaching What Really Happened. We'll go to the phones now and speak to Jose in Bedford. Hi, Jose.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. Oh, hi. Well, I was born in Mexico, and I was a very good student of history, and I can compare the way history is taught, you know, from here to other countries, and it is really poor. You know, I think that the idea of this writer that you have on the air today is to connect the dots on how history becomes relevant from the events of the past to what is going on now. Like during the Civil War in 1961 to 65, the Mexican army defeated the Napoleonic army of France and kicked them out of Mexico. If that never happened, maybe Napoleon would move in here.
Yep.
If the South win, I mean, the changes could have been so dramatic, you know. Unfortunately, the kids here learn about myths and lies, and it's really very sad to not present the idea of the independence of Texas, for instance. They were granted the right of land here if they take the Mexican citizenship, and then they were granted land, and later on they decided to become independent. It's like you inviting someone to your house, and they kick you out of your house after a while, you know. Or
yep.
The Treaty Guadalupe Hidalgo with California and Arizona and all that land that was practically stolen, you know, from Mexico. And
well, let me ask you this.
See that
do you find,
of fairness.
Did you find that history is better taught in Mexico?
Much better, because
yeah.
We take world history, we study U.S. history, Mexican history, and I think there's more emphasis on history and geography.
Yeah,
and here, our kids don't learn any of those two things.
I sometimes think that it would be a good thing if each country outsourced its history to somebody else.
Huh.
And I think it would be a wonderful idea, and maybe you're the man to do it, but I suspect there is a good history of the United States published in Spanish in Mexico, and there is no such book published in the U.S. translated into English. I think that would have a market. I think it would be very interesting for us to read a history of the United States as written from the viewpoint of Mexico.
We have an email here from Bonnie in Tyler who wants to know what she think about history taught at the elementary level. She says, I teach fifth grade where we're responsible for American history from discovery to the Civil War. Interesting that it starts with discovery by the Europeans. FYI, contemporary fifth graders do not get the relevance of figures like Anne Hutchinson and Roger Williams, two historical figures called out by our state standards.
Yeah. Well, I think that history is not well taught anywhere. I don't mean anywhere in the U.S., I hope our caller is an exception, and there are lots of exceptions. But I don't think it's well taught in the primary grades. I think that the teachers, and for that matter parents, in the primary grades are often apt to say, well, let kids be kids. You know, we don't want to teach them really bad stuff, and because they'll have nightmares, they'll be upset, and so on.
And a lot of it's nasty. We have, you know, a lot of it is things that we ought not to be proud of.
Yeah, I think we have to teach those things, of course. And I have to say that I'm glad your emailer teaches fifth grade, because I've taught fifth grade. I've taught it twice. That is, for one day each time in two different school systems. So I do know something about what I'm talking about. I've never taught grades 1 through 4. But the first time I ever taught fifth grade, it was in a very diverse middle school in Stamford, Connecticut. It had some of the richest students in America and some of the poorest. It has Haitian immigrants. It has Latinos, mostly white, but very diverse. And before I started the first day, the first moment, what I was going to do was teach each fifth grade class throughout the day as they rotated into this room for their for history, and until I'd finished the whole class, the whole grade. And I did do that. But before the very first class, the assistant principal who had brought me in said to me, "Well, now, Jim, what are you going to do with these kids?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to show them some of these." And I showed her a batch of photos, which I had on transparency. Some of these photos are in my new book, Teaching What Really Happened. One of them was a photo of a lynching. One of them was a photo of a slave or an ex-slave who had escaped from slavery, but who has it's a very famous photo. His back has been scarred by having been whipped some 6 months earlier. One of them is an ad for cream of wheat that shows a little 5-year-old kid being pulled by his black babysitter in his coaster wagon. And the little boy is whipping his black babysitter, who's an elderly man, and saying, "Get up, uncle." And the cream of wheat people, in their infinite wisdom, the coaster wagon says cream of wheat, think that this would make most Americans feel warm and friendly in 1913 when they came out with this ad and make them want to buy their breakfast cereal. So I showed the assistant principal some of these pictures, and she immediately said, "Oh, Jim, do you have to?" Meaning, you know, do you have to dwell on this kind of stuff? Well, as soon as she said that, of course, I did have to. but she caused me to come up with the following teaching innovation, which I actually came up with all by myself. Before the first class, I said to the students, now some people tell me that fifth graders are not mature enough to handle what I'm about to show you. Well, what do you suppose happened? They were twice as mature as you and me. They rose to the occasion. They handled it beautifully.
I'm sure you couldn't hear a pin drop after you started with that, too.
Yeah, that's a great introduction. And so I commend that to any teacher. You can, if you're going to treat slavery, let's say, you can say to the class, well, some people tell me that an all-Latino class, for instance, is not mature enough to handle a discussion of slavery because it only happened to black people mostly. It didn't really happen to Mexicans. Well, then they'll rise to the occasion. Or you can say to an all-white class, or to a mixed class. You know, you can phrase it differently depending on who you're talking to. You have a black-white class. You say, some people tell me that an interracial class like this can't handle a discussion of slavery. It's just too intense. You're not mature enough. And blam, they'll handle it fine. At the end of the day, well, let me say, finish my story in Stanford. The very first class, I showed this picture I mentioned at some length, the cream of wheat ad. And I walked the students through it. What do you see? And so on. They need to understand that the aged black babysitter is not the boy's uncle. Uncle was a term of quasi-respect that we used in this terrible era of 1890 to 1940 when we were so racist. We wouldn't want to say Mr. or Sir because that would imply black folks are fully human. So we said uncle or auntie if they're female. We still have these terms of Uncle Ben's rice, Aunt Jemima pancake syrup. So I explained that to them, but they got the rest of it. And then I said, okay, now imagine that you are the little boy in this picture. But now you're, instead of 5 years old, 45 years old. And you're going through some stuff in your grandma's attic, and you come upon this picture. What do you think? And the very first comment was from a little white boy right in the middle of the room. He said, "Ooh, what was I thinking?" Now, that's very economical. Four words, what was I thinking, and a ooh. And I submit he got it. And so at the end of the day, the assistant principal who brought me said, "Well, Jim, how did it go?" And I said, "Well, it went fine." And I gave her that example. And she replied, "I knew they could handle it."
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about James Lowen's new book, Teaching What Really Happened. Let's go next to Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hi, Chris. Once again, a great show.
Thanks.
You know, I heard something really special on the BBC on Saturday night by a guy named Russell Ackoff. They were doing a thing on him, and he said that the entire Western way of learning is basically upside down on itself. And he said that teachers generally are teaching themselves when they teach. And he, it was just like all these crazy thoughts. And as it applies into this, my question kind of is, and you know, he said that basically, you know, an educated workforce, an educated group of people, for the people that know what they're talking about, know more than the people that are trying to teach them, in a sense. And my question is, and it's hard enough to get kids to read books. God, I know that because, you know, I was a kid once. But to give a kid The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, or to give a kid Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, are you essentially giving them the history that took place, but giving them something that they eventually, you can't run from that type of experience. If you finish that book, no way. It'll catch up with you eventually, and you'll understand what happened to the Indians, and you'll understand slavery from that perspective. And once again, a great show. I just want to see what you guys think about that.
Thanks for the call. What do you think, Jim? Should we incorporate fiction?
Well, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee is actually not fiction. It's a nonfiction book. I think in some ways we should incorporate fiction, and I got one novel that I'm going to recommend without reservation. It's the only historical novel that I recommend without reservation, and it's about Oklahoma, and so it's not too far away from your listeners. And that's the novel called Okla Hanali, H-A-N-N-A-L-I. It is a history of the 19th century, fictional, in the form of a biography of an imaginary Choctaw leader named Okla Hanali. And it's still in print. In fact, it's Oklahoma University Press, but you can get it at the library. It starts out a little bumpy, but then the writing is very interesting, just the writing of it. And the history is even more interesting. He says some things about the Alamo I never knew. He says some things about the Civil War in Indian country that I never knew. And every time I checked him out, he was exactly accurate. So that's a fun read that I recommend to everybody, and it'll give you a whole new view of this very important century in American life.
James Lowen is with us. The new book is called Teaching What Really Happened. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James W. Lowen. His new book is called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. What do you suggest to teachers, Jim, who want to sort of break the mold and feel like they can still incorporate the things that they're told by the state board that they need to get across, but have principals or parents to deal with who are much more familiar with the traditional way of teaching history?
Right. Well, I do have some words to say about that. First, I think as they develop their list of 30 to 50 topics that they're going to focus on, and as they develop the skills that they're going to incorporate, such as maybe for one of the topics, reading primary documents and putting them in context and understanding what they have to tell us. Maybe for another one, it'll be learning how to read tables and how to deal with the census and things like that, that they tie those objectives into the Texas state objectives. Every state, including Texas, has perfectly good objectives that they publish that are why they teach social studies and history. They may not really do them, and it may be kind of vague, but still, you know, it helps you legitimize yourself by referring to these goals and objectives. And then I think each teacher needs to bring his or her principal on board by showing them their list of 30 to 50 topics, by saying, we're still using the textbook, we're not jettisoning the textbook, but it becomes one of our tools rather than our only tool, and so on. Now, the principal doesn't want to hear very much because he or she's busy. But they want to hear 5 minutes, maybe 10. and then they're on board, and so they become the first line of defense. But then the next thing that happens, I think, is the course becomes much more interesting than it had, and I get emails like this all the time. And I think that reduces the idea of parental complaints. I don't think very many parents are going to come in and say, well, my daughter really likes her history course, and this is outrageous because I never liked mine. It was so boring. We just read the book, and I want my daughter to just read the book. You know, it's not going to happen like that. Now, of course, I'm parodying it a little bit, but still, if it's a popular course and students like it, well, that's good. And then one more thing I'm going to suggest. Students need to have a certain form of academic freedom. Now, that can get tricky. They don't have the freedom to make up their own facts. They can have an opinion, but they have to base it in fact. And fact means stuff that we all agree upon, stuff that you can show likely happens, stuff that is persuasive to all. But I'll give you an example. In Amherst, Massachusetts, the seventh grade history teacher every fall puts Lord Jeffrey Amherst on trial for genocide. Now, Amherst, in fact, did tell an assistant of his to give smallpox-infected blankets to the Indians, thus quelling Pontiac's revolt. So I think he did it. But the students research it, and the first year at least, they wound up voting 21-10 to convict him. Well, that vote shows that they have academic freedom. They can come out either way. They can find the evidence more or less persuasive. Do you think that's a hot-button topic in Amherst, Mass? You bet it is. Yet he's still there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Juan in Dallas. Hi, Juan.
Hey, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I sort of agree with the panelists today, and I just like to say that the history here is very conveniently brought about only one way, and the reason I say that is I get by many people ask, where am I from, you know, and my language is not English, per se, that's the first language, but I'm not naturalized U.S. citizen, and since I was born, and my relatives are born, they're U.S. citizens, and I just get insulted all the time, and it's just because of these people, narrow view of who is American, and they cannot understand, like, that one point on. Never talk in history, or the only thing you hear about Native people here is the Trail of Tears, and besides that, if it's anything taught, it's just erroneous history.
Yeah.
And people who are on the other side of the history get just erased from it.
And, you know, the state of Montana...
It's just really sad, you know?
Yep. The state of Montana has passed a law about 5 years ago called Indian Education for All Act. And it's a terrific bill. Among other things, it says, look, we've got some districts that are overwhelmingly Native American. We've got other districts that have no Native Americans in them. But they all need to have an accurate knowledge of Native American history in Montana and throughout the country. And so now they're actually trying to comply with this law, and they're really doing some stuff. And since then, South Dakota passed the same law. And so I want to propose that some of you listeners who care about these issues find out about this law. It's on the web, Indian Education for All, put that in quotes and type in Montana. You can get it, you can literally get it physically or by the web, you know, by downloads, and get Texas to pass it.
What's the best way to get kids thinking critically, assuming that a teacher has broken away from the textbook and is teaching? I'm guessing that teacher wants his or her students to ask questions.
Sure.
And to say, well, how's that the case?
Well, I got a really cool way. I'm not sure it's the best way, but it's a very inexpensive way. And bizarrely enough, it relies on textbooks. Namely, instead of just having one textbook, teachers can collect old ones. They're cheap. Many used bookstores, in fact, won't even handle them because there's so little demand for them. But when you do find them, they're 50 cents to a dollar often. And so I know a teacher, for instance, who has about 30 of these. And they date from 1924 to the present. I actually have a collection, and mine date from 1824 to the present. And my 1824 one just cost me $3. So you stick them, she sticks hers, in a rectangular plastic laundry basket in the corner of the room. And then on various topics, several times during the year, she says to her class, okay, go get a book, meaning go get one of these textbooks, not your regular textbook that we're using, but one of these. And so she does it, for instance, on President Herbert Hoover. And so Susie gets a book that says President Hoover cared deeply about poor people and the plight of folks during the Depression. He had been in charge, after all, of relief operations in Europe after World War I. He had been in charge of relief operations in Mississippi after the 1927 flood there. He cared about people. He didn't know what to do. He flailed about. He tried different stuff. Meanwhile, Johnny gets a book that says he was a self-made millionaire, and he thought that folks who were still poor, they hadn't tried hard enough, and he really didn't think very much about poor people. And then Ernie, he has a book saying, well, he did care about poor people, but he was constricted by his Republican minimalist government viewpoint. And so, in other words, there's different viewpoints in different books. So you suddenly realize it makes no sense to, quote, learn the book, unquote. What are we going to do? Well, we have to go actually and off to the evidence and find stuff out. And so I think that's one way to get students criticizing their textbook.
I think one thing that's so challenging about that, Jim, is that it requires teachers and students to leave room for some ambiguity, to recognize the fact that Hoover did work hard for the poor in different organizations and was often blamed for not doing enough as president.
Yeah, that's right.
How is it that we misrepresent our heroes, and what's the danger in that when we absolutely lionize some figure in American history to the extent that we don't mention, for example, the slave ownership of the first several presidents?
Yeah, I have a good story to tell about that, too. Most of our presidents before Lincoln, of course, were slave owners, and the two directly before him were not. I'm talking about Pierce and Buchanan, but they were members of the far-out pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party. And all of the predecessors before then, except the two Adamses and maybe one other guy or two other guys, were, in fact, slave owners. Well, a teacher in Illinois said this to her sixth grade class, almost in passing, in October, when she's talking about Washington and Jefferson, some of the early presidents. She said, by the way, all of our presidents, or most of our presidents before Lincoln, were slave owners. And her students immediately were outraged with her. No, they weren't, Miss Walker. If they were, that'd be in the book. Look, we got 5 pages about Washington. We got 7 pages about Thomas Jefferson. We got 3 pages about Andrew Jackson. Doesn't say nothing about them being slave owners. Well, of course, the three I've mentioned and most of the rest were indeed slave owners. But Miss Walker, instead of just yelling at the class like I probably would have done, she says, okay, you folks, maybe I'm wrong. Why don't we get 2 persons for each president, and you look it up and come back tomorrow and tell me what you find out. So, of course, they find out that she's absolutely right the next day, and they come back, and now they're outraged with the book. So what are they going to do? Well, they finally decided to write a collective class letter to the alleged author of the book and to the textbook company. Well, the author never replied. As I might have mentioned already, all too often the authors of these books, famous people that they are, never wrote the book. But they did get a reply back from the publisher. And the publisher said something like this: Dear Ms. Walker's sixth grade class, thank you very much for your helpful feedback about our product. It is from consumers like you that we are able to improve our product. Well, you know, this is boilerplate. So far, this might have been about a fishing rod, you know. Finally, they get a specific paragraph that says, if you will look at pages 804 to 809, you will see a 5-page treatment of the civil rights era. Now, the class looks at each other. What's this got to do with what they brought up? Well, it's black, isn't it? So I submit this is a win-win situation for the class, because either their critique and their letter will actually improve the world. They'll get a letter back from the publisher saying, you got a point, we're going to fix our product. Or they get back a letter like this showing that nobody's home intellectually at the publisher, and therefore they better read with skepticism for the rest of the school year.
What can we all do as taxpayers, as parents, as teachers in some cases, to empower the people who write these textbooks to make them factually correct and engaging and take some risks?
Well, I want to make a suggestion that's an end run around the problem, and it's a very important suggestion. I mean it seriously. Back in the day, that is like in 1950, if you're in, let's say, Cumbie, Texas, Cumbie is an all-white town that's all-white on purpose, and it's a little ways east and maybe a little bit south of Dallas, and I've been there. And Cumbie did have a high school, I believe. If you have any library at all, your library is maybe a single room 10 feet by 15 feet, and it's the library for both the high school and for the community. In other words, you don't got no resources, or not much, for teaching American history. So you need the 1,000-page history textbook. But today, you don't. Even if you're in a backward place like Cumbie, you have access to the web, and therefore you have access to huge websites with all kinds of photographs and documents and original sources and secondary sources and so on. You do not need this 1,100-page behemoth. And so I think that Dallas and every other school district in Texas, Highland Park and University Park and so on, needs to adopt, instead of these 1,100-page hardbound texts, a 300-page paperback. And these exist. And in fact, the price for buying one is about the same price as the price for supplying, on a loan basis, the huge hardbound textbooks, because they cost about $7 and last about $70 and last about 7 years, so that's $10 a year. And that way, the student has a book that he or she owns. When the teacher makes an important point, they can write it in the margin. If they make a good criticism of the book, they can write that in the margin. And when the school year is done, they take the book home, and now they're starting a book collection. They actually own a book, and it's a book they've even read.
The last thing I want to ask you about is in terms of the Internet, what do you think about, say, history on Wikipedia?
What do I think about history on Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Well, I think Wikipedia is actually one of the better organized parts of the web. But in Wikipedia, as well as in the rest of the web, the quality varies a lot. And I actually think that's one of the strengths of the web. And I'll give you an example.
And I want to tell you, we have about 15 seconds left.
Well, I won't give you an example. I'll just say that there's really bad stuff on the web, as well as really good stuff on the web. And so it forces students to be critical readers. And isn't that what we want in the first place?
The new book by James W. Lowen is called Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
The hour went fast.
Good. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.